From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Experts can help us make better decisions in our lives. But expertise can be misused in some public policy debates. An expert political scientist from North Carolina State University will help us learn how. North Carolina's opioid epidemic is having a negative, deadly impact on the state's youngest residents. The head of the state's Child Fatality Task Force explains how. The United States faces many high-level foreign policy challenges. A former top U.S. Homeland Security advisor detailed them during a recent speech at Duke University. You'll hear what she had to say. And North Carolina electric ratepayers stand to benefit now that the feds have agreed to scrap a policy called the Clean Power Plan. You'll learn why. Those topics are just ahead. But first, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Since President Trump was elected, Democratic state attorneys general have filed an unprecedented number of legal challenges to his executive orders. North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein hasn't actually initiated any of those challenges himself, but recently he did add his name to a lawsuit filed by the California Attorney General. This one relates to the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. John Guzet, the John Locke Foundation's Director of Legal Studies, is following this case and others. He joins us to talk about them. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
What is this Obamacare case all about?
Well, the issue has to do with a section of the Act. It's 1402, which authorizes the Department of Health and Human Services to make subsidy payments to insurance companies to reimburse them for the cost of something that's also mandated under the Act, which is that they reduce certain costs and fees to certain insured people who are low and middle income brackets.
These are the subsidies that some folks signing up for Obamacare would receive.
Right. Now, it's important to distinguish. There's two kinds of subsidies under Obamacare. There's a section 1401, which reduces premium payments. And that's one form of subsidy, but that applies actually to people all the way up to 400% of the poverty level. But these under 1402 also reduce things like co-payments, prescription payments, and things like that. Out-of-pocket expenses, those are also reduced. It requires insurance companies to charge them a little less for these things. But under the Act, the insurance companies are supposed to get reimbursed for the cost of those subsidies. And that's what the issue is. How do they get reimbursed?
Now, the Trump administration has decided not to provide those reimbursements.
They're going to stop making them. That's right.
Okay. Is that then the legal basis for the challenge by these a number of state attorneys general, including Josh Stein?
Well, ostensibly it is. What they've said in their complaint is that these payments are funded under Obamacare and that the president has an obligation to make them, which is ironic because a federal judge has already said that those payments are in fact unconstitutional. There's nothing in Obamacare that provides funding for them. And, you know, under our Constitution, an important check and balance is that all appropriations have to originate in the legislature. The president can't spend money unless it's been appropriated by Congress.
This is fascinating, John, because if those payments to the insurance companies are unconstitutional, they have been being made, those payments to the insurance companies, up until now. So how is it possible for both of those things to be true?
Well, they can't both be true. And I suppose if this lawsuit ever reaches a federal court, we'll find out which one is true. But it seems perfectly clear to me that in this case, the Trump administration is right, and the Josh Stein and the other attorneys general are just – I can't even think of the right word. They're just making trouble for the sake of making trouble or perhaps as a way of virtue signaling. But the Act is perfectly clear. There's nothing in it about appropriations for these measures, and there's no reason why there needs to be. There's lots and lots of federal laws that require expenditures but don't appropriate money And when that happens, it happens all the time. The administration goes to Congress and they ask for an appropriation. And if Congress wishes to, it makes the appropriation. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And when it doesn't, then the president's hands are tied and he can't spend the money.
Now, the fascinating thing about what you've just touched on is that when the Affordable Care Act was passed, Democrats were in control, right? And so spending, they could have approved spending. But with Republicans in control of Congress, they don't want to approve the spending? Is that what that's coming down
yes,
to?
Yes, that's right. I mean, if they had wanted to, if they'd known what they were doing when they passed that act, if they'd read it, they probably would have noticed, or they might have noticed, that they hadn't made an appropriation. Although, as I say, it's not unusual to pass a law and expect the appropriations to be made later. But because of the way they did it, they, as everybody knows now, they alienated the Republicans in Congress, and they lost any ability to expect them to cooperate. And they also alienated the American public, which was adamantly opposed to this act. So as a result, they lost control of the House. And once that happened, in the first year in which those expenditures were supposed to be made, the Obama administration went to Congress and asked for an appropriation to make those payments. The Republicans said no. And so instead of accepting that, as he could have done, or perhaps going to court and try to get a court to solve this out, he did what he always does. He just acted on his own without congressional authorization. He made the payments anyway.
You're talking about President Obama.
President Obama. He made the payments anyway. The House of Representatives sued him. It went to court, and a federal judge said the House is right. These funds haven't been appropriated, and so the president can't make those payments. And she issued an injunction putting a stop to them. However, she stayed it. She put it on hold pending an appeal because she didn't want to disrupt the medical insurance marketplace unnecessarily, the assumption being that there would soon be an ultimate determination on this matter. However, both parties decided to put the whole appeal process on hold in the hopes that Congress would sort it out, which is, of course, what ought to happen. They made this problem. They should sort it out. But as we know, that hasn't happened either. So the Trump administration finally decided enough is enough. We're not going to go on making these illegal payments.
John, it's sort of a head scratcher because it appears that really this is an issue of whether representatives, the folks who have been elected to Congress to represent the different districts in the country, really make a decision, yes or no. And so I'm trying to figure out how this is a legal issue that the attorney general would sign on to. Well, it sounds like it's just an issue of whether or not there's the votes there in Congress to go forward with this.
Well, I think although I was tempted at first to say maybe Josh Stein and all these other states' attorneys general should be subject to Rule 11 sanctions for filing a lawsuit that they knew was frivolous and just a form of harassment, I guess there's still a colorable claim here. We haven't seen what their argument's going to be, but presumably they're going to try to argue that somehow or other there are the parts of Obamacare for which permanent appropriations have been made, and they're presumably going to try to argue that somehow those should be extended to include 1402, which is the part that makes these particular payments. A federal judge has already said that's not right. The U.S. Attorney General's office has also analyzed this and said it's not right. But if it gets to court, there's still a claim to be answered.
John, this, what I would call a phenomenon, and you tell me if maybe that's an overstatement, but of attorneys general, states' attorneys general, banding together to sue a presidential administration. Is this new, or have I just not been paying attention to this?
Well, if it's been happening in the past, I haven't been paying attention either, because I wasn't aware of this under, for instance, the Obama administration, which did this all the time. Obama would make executive orders that many people thought were unconstitutional, but I don't remember the state attorney general suing him. But this has happened repeatedly, and it's not the first time Josh Stein has gotten involved. He seems to like that opportunity to be in the spotlight.
Does this hit on any issues of separation of power for you as someone who knows the Constitution, knows the law?
It goes right to the heart of it. I mean, it's very important under our system that the executive branch can't just spend money whenever it wants to. It can only do it when that money's been appropriated. The founders set it up that way with a reason, and the president can't go beyond that simply because he doesn't agree or Congress won't give him what he wants.
Now, when it comes to this case, so we haven't heard yet. Do we have any sort of sense of a timeline as to when this case will go forward, if it will be heard, et cetera?
Well, we've got no idea about that. I mean, there's already the case that was decided by the federal judge that said these payments are illegal. Theoretically, that could go forward, but as I've said, it's on hold. The interesting thing about this is, say what you want about Donald Trump and his political skills, but the fact is this may and already seems to be getting the attention of Congress, so maybe Congress will finally do something and fix this part of the problem they created when they passed the Affordable Care Act.
We've been talking with John Guzet. He is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Legal Studies. You can read this piece that we've been talking about at johnlocke.org. John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's John Locke with an E dot org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Many of us rely on experts to help guide us through complicated decisions. But is it always a good idea to turn to experts? Can expertise be misused? That was the topic of a recent column in Carolina Journal from our next guest. He is Dr. Andrew Taylor, political science professor at North Carolina State University, and I would add, an expert in his field. Thanks for joining us.
So you shouldn't listen to anything that I'm going to be saying here for the next few minutes.
Right. But yeah. What prompted this discussion of expertise and whether it's used correctly or not in public policy debates?
Well, to be honest, Mitch, I've been thinking about it for a long time, but the immediate sort of influence for the CJ piece that you're just talking about was an article I read. I can't remember where. I think maybe in the Washington Post or Wall Street Journal, about this guy in Colorado who sort of got fed up with the effect that smartphones were having on his kids, and decided to try to create this movement to ban the use of smartphones by children under 13 in his state. And where he's an expert on this is in sort of two ways. One is he's a doctor, an anesthesiologist to be exact, but a medical professional, and sort of felt that his expertise allowed him to observe these things in a particular way. And he's a father of five, so he's a kind of professional father, right, as well. And so he's sort of going out there and saying, you know, I know these things. I know these things a lot, and therefore you shouldn't do it. To be fair to him, he's going through the regular political and legal process to try to get this on the ballot in Colorado. And, you know, he does obviously care deeply about the children of his state. But there is this sort of sense that because he is an expert, he sort of feels he has this sort of duty or even maybe right to sort of influence the behavior of other people.
And this is one example, but we see this often where people who have expertise in a certain area say, well, because of that expertise, everyone should do X.
Right. And in fact, particularly at the local level, experts are given special privileged, protected positions in the policymaking process. This is where it really is a problem. It's one thing for a policymaker, a president, a mayor, a governor, to surround himself with experts and say, look, you know a lot about this. Advise me. And the experts advise the policymaker, the decision maker, and the decision maker sort of measures up everything, takes all the advice from disparate sources and makes the call. But in local law, we often provide experts with, because of their expertise, privileged positions where they actually make the call themselves, and the decisions that they make have the force of law. And those of us who aren't experts, for example, in land use decisions, planning decisions, those of us who aren't engineers, aren't environmental scientists, aren't even allowed at the table. The decisions are made by those experts. And that's where, of course, it's particularly worrying.
We are chatting with Dr. Andrew Taylor of NC State University. Some people might be hearing us and saying to themselves, well, shouldn't the experts be the ones making the decision? Shouldn't we just leave this to the experts? Why is that not correct?
Well, no, that's an awful thing to do. The experts can advise, but they shouldn't be making the decisions. There are a number of reasons for that. First of all, unless they're elected in some way or directly accountable to the public, then that, you know, that would be obviously anti-democratic. We don't want to elevate people based upon what they know. We want to elevate people to these positions based upon their accountability to the people in the jurisdiction, whether it be a county, a state, or the nation as a whole. Also, I think experts suffer from sort of two kind of personality problems here. One is in their relationship to generalists. I think generalists have a better ability to bring in broader sets of data and diverse voices to apply basic philosophical principles across the board to integrate issues which obviously compete with one another in the public policy realm. So I think that's very important, and experts are unable to do that. And I also think there's a sense today in our society that we've elevated experts onto this pedestal, and they've kind of believe that they really know what's best for everybody when they aren't particularly capable sometimes, I think, because they're so they've become these sort of evangelists and they're so drawn to what they know, they haven't been able to do a very good job of putting their knowledge in broader economic, social, and moral perspective. And so, no, the short answer to that is no, we shouldn't let them take over and make all the decisions for us.
And in some respects, the politics of recent years, I'm thinking most especially of the 2016 presidential race, shows that some people are seeing somewhat of a backlash to this reliance on expertise and saying, wait a minute, all of you experts have gotten us here. This is not where we want to be.
Exactly. I think some of the, you know, there was a lot going on in 2016, and there are a lot of reasons why Donald Trump won and Hillary Clinton lost. But I think part of it was, as you said, Mitch, that there is a backlash to this expertise. We've elevated again. We're in a society where we're all sort of experts on one little thing. And we really look down our noses at the sort of broadly trained and educated person who understands the world broadly, who can integrate things. We poo-poo that person. We want to put the experts in charge. But there is a profound sort of disappointment with the direction of the country. We are not getting economic growth. We're not getting sort of satisfaction of the way things are going at the moment. And I think the Trump campaign did a really good job in sort of saying, not necessarily Hillary Clinton herself, but sort of what she stands for is to put a lot of experts in control of government. And look where it's got us. Obama was the same. I'm a generalist. I sort of have run a business, but I will hire smart people, but I'll make the call. And that resonated a lot during the campaign, I think.
You're not saying, we should be clear, that we should get rid of the experts or throw out the expertise, just place the experts and their expertise in the proper setting.
Yeah, you do it two ways. First of all, you have a really smart generalist in charge who is skilled at picking experts and listening to them. But then also being able to filter what these diverse set of experts have said and then make the call. And secondly, have a diverse set of experts who can, in a sort of Madisonian checking and balancing way, who know a lot about what they're dealing with and about their issue area, and then just put them all around the table and have them hash it out with one another. Rather than putting them in the driver's seat and sort of genuflecting their knowledge and expertise and deferring to them. That clearly isn't the way that we should go.
I'm guessing you would also add into that mix, make sure that there's some sort of mechanism for normal folks who aren't bringing any expertise to weigh in and say,
look, all you experts, here's how what you're talking about is going to affect us.
Exactly, exactly. And hope, and we need sort of a feedback loops and accountability mechanisms to do that. And of course, if you have a technocracy, we haven't used that term yet, but this is sort of the academic term for a system like this. If you have a technocracy where experts are in charge and unaccountable because we believe we should just defer to their knowledge, you are not going to have a place for the regular folks at the table.
Well, he is an expert in the field of political science, but you should still listen to him anyway. Dr. Andrew Taylor is a professor of political science at North Carolina State University, also a columnist for Carolina Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams. Visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's John Locke with an E.org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's Child Fatality Task Force is focusing attention on the state's opioid epidemic. Executive Director Kella Hatcher recently explained during a presentation to the John Locke Foundation.
When it comes to harmful substances, you can't tune into a news source lately without seeing something about the opioid epidemic. And while opioids are only one of multiple types of harmful substances, the opioid epidemic is certainly something that the task force has been paying close attention to. In just 15 years, we've gone from seeing under 200 deaths per year to seeing over 1,000 a year. And that recently we've seen a dramatic increase in these deaths. While the number of kids who are 17 and under who actually die from an opioid overdose is very small, especially in comparison to the other age groups, the impact of this epidemic on the adults in kids' lives has a huge impact on kids. When we look at substance use impacts on children, there are very specific areas that the task force looks at that are impacted by harmful substances. And one of those is child maltreatment. As part of the task force efforts to reduce fatalities, we have to examine and make recommendations concerning child abuse and neglect. And in recent years, we've seen a rise in the number of kids entering foster care related to parental substance use. Another area is infant health. A major focus of our perinatal health committee is the impact of substance use on prenatal health and infants. Whether it's drugs, alcohol, or tobacco, these substances really do have a significant impact on birth outcomes, infant mortality rates, and child health and well-being. Poisoning is a topic of discussion in our unintentional death prevention committee, where much of the discussion focuses on reducing access to substances or addressing poison first aid when it occurs. The unintentional death prevention committee also focuses on accidents, many of which are connected to alcohol and drug use, or could be connected to. In North Carolina, alcohol is involved in about one-third of fatal crashes, and it's estimated that drugs other than alcohol are involved in about 18% of motor vehicle driver deaths. And besides motor vehicle accidents, impairment from substances can be a primary or contributing factor in other types of accidents, including those on watercraft, falls, and other injuries. And then finally, of course, you've got multiple potential negative impacts for youth who use and abuse substances.
Hatcher recapped the dangers of substance abuse.
Substance use puts kids at greater risk for engaging in delinquent activities, which can involve violent crime. And substance misuse also puts kids at greater risk for suicide.
That's Kella Hatcher, Executive Director of the North Carolina Child Fatality Task Force. She's discussing the impact of the opioid epidemic on young people in this state. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A Duke University audience recently heard expert opinions on some of the top homeland security challenges facing the Trump administration. The expert was Lisa Monaco. She was U.S. Homeland Security Advisor to President Obama, but worked on similar issues in both Republican and Democratic administrations. Her first topic, long-term recovery from major hurricane damage.
Over the longer term, from a strictly White House perspective, and having been in a role that had me juggling a number of different crises, and not only responding to the crisis, but, and this sounds boring, but focusing on the long-term implementation, right? Maintaining focus. This is a challenge for any White House, right? After the cameras go away, after the breaking news banners go away, there is a lot of hard work of implementing the recovery. And that means bringing a full suite of tools to bear. It means housing recovery. This is a big issue in Katrina. We ended up having the then Secretary of Housing, Sean Donovan, chairing an interagency task force with everybody from HHS, the Health and Human Services, to the Army Corps of Engineers, understanding and thinking about how they were going to provide housing, rebuild at a resilient level. So focusing on the housing issues, you know, hundreds of thousands of people being displaced in Florida alone, environmental issues, health issues, toxins in the floodwater. So there's a whole range of issues that the federal government is going to have to continue to focus on. Maintaining that White House leadership and focus is a real challenge as the crises from foreign and domestic will continue to come at officials in the White House. So that means setting up a structure that can be led from the White House with very clear goals and objectives to continue to implement. And it's going to be not weeks, not days, but months and years for this recovery effort.
Monica also turned to North Korea and dictator Kim Jong-un.
Look, I think we have to step back when we think about what ought to be our objective here, right? And let's think about who is this guy, right? Who is Kim Jong-un? Now, I and others have used words like he's unhinged and, you know, trying to send the message that he's not a rational actor. Well, the fact of the matter is he is exceedingly paranoid. He is indescribably violent. But he's rational. Why do I say he's rational? He's rational because he is, and it gets at what you just said, David, he is focused on, as his ancestry has been, on maintaining the regime's hold on North Korea. And he does view his nuclear capability as his ace in the hole. So I'm with Jim Clapper and other experts on this, which is to say that denuclearization is really not realistic. It does not seem, at least there's no, I haven't seen any signs that that's realistic. We should be focused, I think, on deterrence. And I will also say that a key ingredient of deterrence is a credible threat of military action. So while I have differed and have done so publicly with some of the rhetoric on this about fire and fury and the like, I do believe a clear, consistent message, such as the one Secretary Mattis recently delivered, of military options being on the table, as unattractive as they are, is an important element of deterrence.
Can the U.S. live with a nuclear North Korea?
I think we have to be acknowledge that he, and we've been seeing this steady march, and it has been a steady march, right? He has developed a nuclear capability, and we've seen the most significant test now of a couple weeks ago. There's four elements, just to review here, for a threat that we are focused on here in the homeland, right? Nuclear capability, we've seen a very significant test. Missile delivery, we've seen repeated steady march on testing of the missile delivery system. Miniaturization of a nuclear warhead that could be affixed to that missile delivery system. And we've seen some, in a leaked intelligence report, that one element of our intelligence community, the Defense Intelligence Agency, believes that that capability is there, that miniaturization capability. I personally would like to see what our full intelligence community says about that, but still very concerning. And the fourth element is reentry, the ability to put that miniaturized nuclear capability onto the missile delivery system and have it reenter from the Earth's atmosphere into the target. And that, our intelligence community does not believe is there yet, but still, we've seen a steady march and a repeated effort to attain all of those capabilities. But as somebody who's focused on the threat to the homeland, we have to be very clear about where Kim Jong-un is on that march. And so we should be focused on, in my view, deterrence. We should have a clear view about where he is on that steady march to get those capabilities. We should be increasing our defense capability, and we are steadily doing that. We should be reassuring our partners and allies and working with them, South Korea and Japan being first among them, quite obviously. We should be working on a covert and other means to sabotage, derail, slow, and roll back, hopefully, the gains that Kim Jong-un has made. And applying steady and increased pressure, including sanctions. And I give credit to, and I think the administration should be given credit for the successes they have had at the UN in unanimous Security Council resolutions. But those, you know, and some of the weaknesses of some of them have already been pointed out. But nevertheless, they have been unanimous resolutions, and that has been very important. But we can do some on our own as well. Unilateral sanctions from the United States, pressure on China and Chinese banks that continue to do business with North Korea. So those are the tools that I think we should be employing, all toward hopefully a diplomatic solution to this.
What about long-term threats of another 9/11 attack?
We have been successful in diminishing the threat of a complex foreign-directed attack of catastrophic proportions such as we faced on and suffered on 9/11. And that is owing to the tremendous work across Republican and Democratic administrations, from the military, intelligence, law enforcement, homeland security, diplomats. And we, as a nation, did a number of things to make that possible. We broke down cultural barriers to how we organize ourselves and share information. We changed our legal structures to make that more possible. And we changed our structures, and we created new structures, including the organization that I was privileged to lead before I went to the White House, the National Security Division of the Justice Department. So we built up a net, an apparatus to enable us to have success against that type of 9/11 style attack.
That's Lisa Monaco, former U.S. Homeland Security Advisor, speaking recently at Duke. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, the issues and challenges endure. It's Living History, a Living History event starring two incredible actors, Monday evening, November 20th, brought to you by the organization dedicated to advancing freedom, the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's John Locke with an E .org, or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, November 20th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets, $10 per person, but just $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, live in Raleigh, November 20th. Hope to see you there. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Last month, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, moved to repeal the controversial Obama-era emissions guidelines known as the Clean Power Plan. Now, the John Locke Foundation's John Sanders applauds the move. He says it's a win for North Carolinians. John, of course, follows regulatory policy as the Director of Regulatory Studies for the Locke Foundation. He's here to help us understand what's going on. John, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
First of all, what is the Clean Power Plan?
The Clean Power Plan essentially is the EPA regulating carbon dioxide emissions from power plants and taking a look at how each state does it and what each state guidelines are. And if they don't like it, they would insert their own.
What was the goal of this, the genesis of even creating this plan?
The goal, of course, is to prevent all these kind of advertised worldwide ills brought about through global climate change, with the thinking that energy-based emissions are a major contributor to them.
And thinking that if we reduce by mandate the amount of emissions coming out of these power plants, that the air will be cleaner?
Yeah, the air will be cleaner, and therefore we will have lessening in sea level rise, lessening of all the other ill effects of having a warmer climate, so and so.
This was created during the Obama administration, right?
Yes, these were Obama-era rules.
Okay, so then Donald Trump is elected president, and he and his administration evidently have a quite different view of this whole issue. Help us understand the difference between the two administrations.
Well, the Trump administration, one of the aspects of the Trump administration has been to pull back on a lot of regulatory interventions in a host of areas, but including at the EPA. But, you know, stepping back for a minute, the Supreme Court had already issued a stay of the implementation of the Clean Power Plan. North Carolina, through our DEQ under the McCrory administration.
That'd be Department of Environmental Quality, the regulators there.
Right. Had joined a lawsuit with 28 other states that brought about a stay of the plan, which suggested that the Supreme Court did not think that it would uphold, that it would stand up under judicial scrutiny.
But despite that, the Trump administration then has done what?
The Trump administration has just recently announced that they are planning to repeal the rule.
Okay. So, John, what does this do for North Carolinians? You've written that you think this is a big win. Why?
I think it's a huge win for North Carolinians because the rule would have significant economic costs. It would impose, depending on who you read, but it would impose something along the lines of $366 billion in compliance costs. It could force double-digit electricity rate increases. It would shutter a lot of existing coal power plants.
How would it increase our rates if it were to go forward?
Well,
how would that happen?
And in shutting these plants down and in imposing new regulations, it would make the provision of electricity that much more expensive.
Because utility companies would have to go to other forms of energy?
That was in part of it, and in part it would make it more expensive, and it would require new built power plants, and all of those things would factor into the rates.
So when you write that it's a win for North Carolinians, you're talking about real cash here, people's household budgets just to pay their monthly electric bill. You're saying that it would be not as expensive now that the EPA is moving to get rid of the Clean Power Plan.
Yes.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about emissions, John, because you've been following that. Along with this whole regulatory effort under the Clean Power Plan, you have been noting that while all of this was going on, all of these new ideas about mandating and regulating power plants, there was a whole lot of things going on in the energy industry that seemed to be showing that those regulations weren't needed. Tell us about that.
Well, absolutely right. In North Carolina and the United States and in 35 industrialized countries, energy-based emissions have been falling all century. You know, it's 2017, and these have been falling all century. The reason they've been falling is not because of a government plan, especially in the United States, it's not even taken effect. They've been falling because of market forces. These include technological innovations, changes in consumer preferences, changes in the economies themselves. A lot of these have transitioned to more service economies and manufacturing economies. Changes in electricity generation. The technological innovation in the recovery of natural gas has made it more cost competitive, price competitive with coal. And so North Carolina and in the United States, we've seen a transition over to more natural gas, which burns a lot more cleanly than coal.
When you talk about those technological innovations, specifically having to do with finding more reserves, you're talking about fracking?
Yes.
And help us understand what's happened with the fracking industry.
Well, the marriage of two long-term technologies, which was horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing of drilled wells, has produced very cheap, relatively cheap recovery for natural gas and oil. And the United States is replete with both of those that have been long time trapped in shale rock formations. But now that they're able to be released the way that they are, it's a plentiful and cheap fuel source.
Is it cleaner as well?
Yes, it's much cleaner than coal.
So when people talk about being concerned about fossil fuels, the fact that these other forms of energy have taken off and are cheaper in some cases, working together, that means that we've kind of already the market forces have started to reduce those emissions and made things cheaper.
Yes.
Well, it's a really interesting story. And of course, all of this, as we mentioned at the very beginning of this discussion, John, has to do with those who believe that climate change, that global warming is something that governments, not just the U.S. government, but governments around the world should be addressing. Where does that stand? Let's say that even if the Clean Power Plan were to be implemented, even though now it looks like it will not be, what would this do to the issue of emissions and worldwide climate change and global warming?
Well, I don't think it would have much of an impact with respect to emissions. I think it would give a visible something that people would point to and say, oh, this is the reason why emissions are down. But that is no longer going to be the case, it doesn't seem like. But emissions still are down, and they are continuing to fall. The one thing that we will be missing from all of this is we'll be missing the costs. So society won't have to shoulder these kind of costs, and we'll still enjoy the benefit of lower emissions and cheaper electricity.
So if folks want to read more about the Clean Power Plan, John, they can go to johnlock.org. They can find all of your work right there, as well as all of your writings about the energy industry, as we've been talking about the different changes and the different types of fuel. It's all available there, written by John Sanders. He's been our guest. He is the Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. We hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.